Hello, Dr. Dyke Drummond here at the home of thehappymd.com in beautiful Seattle, Washington. Welcome to the latest episode of the Physicians on Purpose podcast. Tools so you can recognize and prevent your own burnout. Stories of burnout put to its highest and best use. And wellness leadership strategies. Everything you need to be a physician on purpose. Hello again, Dr. Dyke Drummond in beautiful Seattle, Washington, home of thehappymd.com with the latest edition of the Physicians on Purpose podcast. Today, I'm excited to have Megan Mello, MD, a family practice doc and obesity medicine specialist. She's actually in Seattle with me. I'm in Tacoma. She's in Seattle at her website, healthierforgood.com. Today, we're going to talk about boundaries and the inner game of physician wellness. At least that's what we're setting off to discuss here as we begin our recording.
We never know where we're going to get.
So where should we start? We were talking earlier about, gosh, you got to stop being such a good resident. We were talking about unique boundary issues for female doctors. Where would you like to begin?
Gosh, how long do we have? Let me tell you a little bit about, you know, kind of the people who end up coming to see me as a coach. They are women primarily who are really struggling with this idea of needing to do everything for all people and never being able to say no. And, you know, we were discussing that that comes out of, you know, being a good resident, right? The one who's always the go-getter and, you know, always has all the energy. But it also comes out of this place of many women having been socialized from a very young age to be the good girl. The good girl follows the rules. She's pleasant. She smiles. She goes out and accomplishes all these things. And she's so used to getting external validation from all of that, that she's a great resident. She's a great team leader. She's a great chief. She gets out into practice and then she's miserable because she's drowning. There's no end to it. And as other life responsibilities stack up, right, we might add kids, we might add a partner, maybe we add a leadership position or any other life stuff going on. And there is just not enough time to make everybody happy.
And I've yet to see a study that goes against the knowing that women play a larger role at home, whether or not you have children,
yeah.
Right?
Yeah.
So there's always that stuff in the mix too. Well, and there was some research that came out about 6 or 8 years ago that talked about this particular bias of the patients and the staff that is projected upon the female providers.
Absolutely.
If you have a mixed staff amongst the doctors, some men and some women, mm-hmm. and a patient or a staff member has a question, who do they ask?
Always the woman.
Why do they ask him?
She's easier. She's not going to say no. She's going to give you an answer.
They expect the woman to answer. Yeah. If they have a request, they expect the woman to say yes. And what they did was they quantified the excess work that the women had to do simply because there were women and because of these inbound questions.
Yep.
And it was something like a 20% extra load in the EHR. And right. On the patient portals.
And just patients, you know, in the room. No, I see that all the time. And, you know, I'll be seeing one of my male coworkers' patients. And all of a sudden, I'm getting all these extra questions about not the thing that they were in for. And I'm just like, what? Well, why are you asking me? So, no, it's quite pervasive. And you might also have the reputation in your clinic of being the easiest female physician to ask questions of, right? Because there's gradations there too. So it's very easy to become the easy one who never says no, who always puts her own work down, especially work that isn't burning, right? Like our notes are not burning, our inbox, our eating lunch is not burning, right? It's not on fire, but I better answer this question right now so I don't disappoint someone.
Right, and then here's the evil part. What happens if you don't answer their question?
Oh, yeah.
What happens if you ask them why they're asking you this question? Yeah, the B word.
Right. When the B word comes out, the comments.
The scarlet letter.
The judgment is so much higher. And, you know, I give it this other silly example. We're also expected to contribute to the potluck. And I don't want to suggest that it's wrong that we participate in the potluck. You know, doctors are so good at finding free food. That's another holdover from residency, right? We know, you know, who's got the party going on. But if I, as a woman physician, show up and I don't bring something, homemade or store-bought, but I'm going to have some judgment there too. I'm going to be looked at differently than my male colleague who doesn't show up with something. And those, again, sort of silly perpetuated examples, but they still are true. I remember getting called out for not showing up to a, you know, Saturday afternoon clinic picnic sort of thing. And I was just like, I don't want to spend any more time with clinic people on the weekend and away from my kids. And I got in trouble for that.
Oh my.
Yeah, no, it's very real, you know, kind of these social pressures that exist within gender lines. And, you know, it's true in the patient exam room and it's true in the rest of the space.
Complete disclosure, if you're listening on the podcast, I'm a big old white guy. I'm 65 years old and I always bring food to the potluck. Just so
good for you.
By the way, leadership tip, doctors are just big residents. Whether you're a doctor or not, if you're having a meeting, bring food because that'll goose your attendance.
Yes.
And the other thing I want to say too is that you were talking about your clients who come to you, coaching clients who come to you, women coaching clients. Just to be really clear, a big old white guy like me, I've been coaching since 2010, yeah. 70% of over time, 70% of my clients have been women. Now, it's not about me. It's about the fact that women are more likely to ask for help too. Whereas a man would wrap his ego around appearing to be vulnerable or in need or less than perfect.
Yeah.
But that's another statistic to have in the background is that women also will ask for help, will take breaks once they've broken down their inner resistance.
But interestingly, they won't necessarily ask for help in their existing settings.
Of course not.
There's right? No, they're going to reach for out that. For private help. And yeah, I think that the expectations, you know, in terms of sort of external appearance between men and women is different, right? So the pressures I imagine on men are different. They aren't seen in the same light. They may not be seen as unkind. They may not be called a bitch, but their expectations for, you know, them being able to answer a question, you know, in a different manner than with, yeah, it's all over the place.
It's actually completely opposite, right? So I see this over and over again. And that is that a man can be brusque, off-putting, even profane in the face of a request.
Mm-hmm.
And others in the organization will see that as leadership material.
He's so assertive. She's
right.
Aggressive. He's assertive.
No, she's a B-word and he's assertive or whatever, right?
Yeah.
And you get away with that kind of stuff.
Yeah.
So there is a masculine essence that provides a bubble of safety and protection and nurturing around a group, but that very rarely comes out in the high stress environment of a healthcare environment. You get people snapping at each other and women wishing they could snap rather than feeling compelled to answer or get painted with the B word.
Well, and two, if we look up a generation from myself, you know, when I was a resident and I was working with a tough female attending, right, on various rotations, I really struggled because I didn't really know what was going on. But I can look back and I can see, especially for these women attendings who were in sort of male dominated specialties, my ICU pulmonary person, you know, some of our surgical colleagues, and they had a reputation for being total bitches. That was kind of what they were known for. But I can now look back and see, you know, they needed to do that. They needed to put on that very external hard shell, you know, that kind of masculine energy, if you will, in order to survive. That was the only way that they could gain the respect of their colleagues. But of course, it comes at tremendous cost. Let's not pretend that they were living easy lives because they were constantly being called a bitch.
Nobody's having conversations with them about setting a context. So you can walk into a setting like that, and I, as a male on that team, realizing it's my energy and my culture that's driving that compensation from the woman who's on the team, I could have a conversation with that person ahead of time. I could have a team meeting to welcome a new member onto the team. This could all be very conscious and detoxed, but it would take more awareness than what they're willing to put into their day-to-day behavior.
Yeah. It takes a willingness to participate on the side of the person coming in. Because if you've been kicked around in wherever you've been before, and people are trying to be welcoming and accommodating and, you know, create a culture of vulnerability, there's a lot of people who won't participate in that because they are afraid of being kicked down.
Well, and let's just unwire that word vulnerability from what I'm talking about. if you feel that being open, truthful, honest, and transparent in your communications is an act of vulnerability, meaning that puts you in danger, that is an effect of the culture of the group. What I'm talking about is having a group where that is not perceived as vulnerability. That's the way we do things around here. Open, truthful, honest, and transparent.
Yeah.
So Brené Brown uses the word vulnerability like that too. Like anytime you would tell the truth, you're vulnerable. No. It's the job of the leader to take vulnerability off the table and to openly accept and support and demand honest communications. And if anybody steps on anybody's toes for telling the truth, that leader's got to put the hammer down to get rid of that kind of behavior that would drive fears of vulnerability.
And yet, how often do we see that in play?
Once in a lifetime. You'll see that once in a lifetime, but you'll remember it for the rest of your life.
Yeah.
And the challenge is that's the standard to which all leaders should be held. And in healthcare, it is absolutely and routinely violated 99% of the time. You will fail to find anything like that, mostly because people are overwhelmed. Task overwhelm just takes away. Task overwhelm takes away presence, awareness, quality, satisfaction, all of it.
Well, and what I saw too, and this is probably in your experience as well, that a lot of people who step into leadership roles are stepping into that to step away from clinical medicine and the burdens thereof, right? So they are moving from one place of burnout into a space that they feel things will be better because they don't have as many patients. But then they bump up against the competing interests of kind of the demands of the leader from on high and the concerns of the people that they're serving. And that's a difficult boat to be in as well.
And it takes about 6 months for them to go over to the dark side. No, I have a little video series called, maybe we'll put it in the show notes, Physician Leadership's 5 Dirty Little Secrets. And one of the number one dirty little secret is burnout is a tried and true path to leadership.
Yep.
In my experience, and I've been in front of rooms of 100 senior leaders, for instance, with the Medical Group Management Association, places like that.
Yep.
And I say, how many of you are in your leadership position because you took it to avoid having to see more patients?
How many hands
went up? 70% in every room I've ever been in. So 70% of people who take a leadership position take it because they're burned out seeing patients. That is a terrible reason.
Yeah.
Terrible reason to want to become a leader.
Yeah.
And
let's just say 70% openly admit that that's why they did it.
Right. And the challenge is that the skills that you need to lead a team are completely different than the skills that you need to be a clinician, giving orders and expecting everybody to comply or obey. But we're going to get off on a great big tangent here if we go any further.
Well, although, you know, let's explore where people pleasing shows up there too, right? Because some of these people who are coming into a leadership position are going in, even if they're looking to escape patient care, right? And thinking that's going to be easier. They are also usually stepping into those positions thinking, I can do better. I can serve the boots on the ground staff better. And then they might be in this place where they've got expectations again coming from on high. And, you know, they know the experience of their clinicians, you know, that they're serving. And in that, they either see, you know, I can either make these people happy or I can make these people happy, but there's not going to be a mix. Can't make everybody happy. And I think eventually, yes, they see that they're more beholden to, you know, the kind of the higher ups than they are to these whiny doctors, right? They're taking care of.
Well, that's called piss up, piss down. And the reason it happens is if you look up, there's way less people you have to keep happy. Usually only one. If you look down, there's dozens and hundreds. So that's why, plus the fact that the only time they see a provider after they've reached their leadership position is when the provider's upset and is going to give them a piece of their mind. So it takes about 6 months to break a former clinician in a leadership role into hating the people that are their direct reports and learning just how to stroke up the chain of command to kiss up. And that's true in any organization, but it's especially true in healthcare because there's such a difference between the role that you play as a clinician and the role that you play as a manager. And it is the reason why we feel that our former partners go over to the dark side when they hit management. And they do. Yeah. They behave completely differently 6 months later when we've broken them. And they realize they only have to make one person happy, their boss, as opposed to our whole department, right?
Okay, we'll get off our leadership tangent. Maybe.
Well, and the challenge right now is that the disaster that is American healthcare is a leadership failure, pure and simple, combined with the programming of our medical education that leaves us without boundaries, people-pleasing perfectionists, and the fact that surviving residency is very different than what it takes to build a healthy, happy practice in the long term once you're out of the medical education system. And the only way we can do that now as an employee is to push back against the confines of your job description by having a relationship with this leader person. And you may be a woman and that may be a man or vice versa or however somebody identifies. And that dynamic of relationships in the workplace is the only way that you can get the wiggle room you want to have a close enough match for your ideal practice that you feel like this decision to be a doctor is worthwhile in the first place.
I'd argue too that a lot of this is also wrestling with yourself and your own ideas of being a good doctor are, because so many of us have internalized this idea of what we think a good physician is, what they do, you know, how they interact with people, what they will and won't allow. And when we've internalized that, whether we could name it or not, and we see ourselves not being that thing, we will constantly feel like we're not good enough. And we will constantly feel, I can't say no until I'm that. I can't, you know, decide for myself that I'm going to make some changes because I'm clearly not serving people the way that I should. Because even though often women, you know, might have really good, you know, Prescani scores or, you know, some other kind of metric about patient satisfaction, you know, they often are in their heads not good enough because, again, they're holding themselves up to some kind of standard that, you know, maybe and often is totally unrealistic. But until we understand that and until we give ourselves permission to change our thoughts on that, we're going to stay stuck with or without any negotiations or discussions with other people that we're encountering in leadership or, you know, colleagues or things like that.
And so when you think about that kind of perfectionism, not giving yourself permission to be human, do you think that that comes as a result of gender, upbringing, the conditioning of medical education? Where do you think is the main contribution of that?
Yeah, I think for a lot of people, it's growing up as a good girl. The very long CV full of accomplishments, the being polite, the smiling, right? The being the easy one, the being the one that cares for other people is often socialized into women at a young age, right? I think the socialization that we give boys and males is different.
So when? Course,
when? I think it usually starts quite early, no?
No, to win, boys, to win. We're socialized to win.
Oh, to win, W-I-N. I was like, when? Yes, right, to win. We may stand out, but we shouldn't stand out too much. That's seen as not a feminine quality. So we want to have the well-rounded CV, but we don't want to outshine other people. That's often seen as negative. And so because that starts so early, it gets ramped up in our medical school and residency training, where we have another opportunity to, you know, be the good one, be the hardworking one, be the accommodating one. And again, we graduate from residency, right? We step into our job. We come in with that energy of wanting to be a good employee, knowing that we're junior, wanting to, you know, really succeed and make others happy. And very few of us would ever be sat down by somebody and have that conversation of, you know, you're going to need to let go of that. You're going to need to put that aside. And you're going to need to decide, where are you going to have boundaries? Because you can't do it all. You can't show up this way. You can't always say yes and never say no. You will drown in resentment and frustration and overwhelm and burnout. It's just not possible to do all of these things at this high level and, you know, succeed and or be happy.
And burnout is there. It has a highest and best use. Burnout is there to knock you on a path that has more purpose. Because what ends up happening, the more and more you do things to impress other people or to stay in alignment and be a good resident and do what's expected of you, oftentimes that's in direct conflict with you feeling like you're doing a good job as a physician because you didn't play a role. I know you, dear listener, did not play any role in writing your current job description. They pulled it off a shelf behind the person who was interviewing you. It's pure boilerplate. And it's written to honor two things: the business plan and the revenue model of your employer. And it doesn't give a crap about what you think about the quality of your care. So burnout's there to break you.
it negates the emotional burden and challenge, right, of caring for human beings in struggle. You know, in family medicine, I get to see a lot of well people, but we are privy to people's suffering in mental health, physical health, emotion. You know, like we get to see all of that, and that can't be widgetized. Yes, we need to have some boundaries and emotional separation, but when our healthcare entities want us to be able to put everything into a nice 20-minute tidy box of appointments, and I'll tell you, I had a patient on my schedule. I'll never forget this. She's on my schedule for blood pressure follow-up. I'd seen her the month before. I walked into the room. She burst into tears and told me, you know, trigger warning here, like that her brother had committed suicide in front of her the day before. And she didn't mention any of that to anybody else.
Right? Saved it for you.
I walk into the room and I get smacked with that. She's my first visit of the day. And I spent more than 20 minutes with her, and I don't think we did anything with her blood pressure. That kind of experience happens, maybe not that unique experience, right? But that kind of thing can happen to us in medicine all the time. And the possibility of that is blatantly missed by these very rigid schedules. Well, we all have, you know, appointments of this length, and you're supposed to meet all the little metrics and, you know, check all your little boxes. There's another good girl thing. You check all the boxes, right? Get all your to-do list items done of your HEDIS metrics and whatever else. We can't widgetize care like that. It doesn't work very well.
I love that verb.
You can borrow it.
Thanks. Widgetize. There's a GPT for that.
I don't know how you solve that, right? Because you never know. You never know what's coming in. But it's often ignored in the desire for streamlining and making everybody sort of the physicians all get the same in terms of, you know, the number of appointment slots or the time allotted for patient care, despite knowing that sometimes these kinds of, you know, emotional bombs are going to drop in our lap, or, you know, that the women physicians are going to get more questions than their male colleagues, you know, both in and outside of the exam room. There's this desire for fairness. But you can't create fairness by just deciding that the schedule is this way.
It's not an attempt to create fairness. I want to be really clear. It's an attempt to maximize income. It has nothing to do with fairness, ethics, human communication, quality of care, patient satisfaction. None of that. It's an attempt to maximize.
The language that comes at that individual is it would not be fair for you to see fewer people. You're right. The underlying issue is always the revenue, right? It's always, you know, how can we maximize the amount of money coming in?
Well, that's like when two of your partners quit and they're asking you to see their patients and you push back a little bit and they question your ethics. That's evil management.
You're not being a team player.
That's evil management. That person should be instantly transported to the fires of hell to live there eternally, burning every day. It's evil. It is something that only bad managers will do. If somebody's doing that to you right now, just so you know, it's got nothing to do with you. It's that manager pulling an evil card. And everybody on the business side of the house is attempting to maximize the return for their investors, whatever those investors are, the sisters in Rome or whatever. So that is where the interface between the art of medicine and the business of capitalism, having chosen healthcare as an industry in the United States of America, we'll let the capitalists run free and rape and pillage and plunder whatever they want. And that is something that is an interface that has to be acknowledged so that it can be managed for everybody, dear listener, who's an employee. Because the job of burnout is to push you to the point where you change your actions and change your thought processes to find some wiggle room inside this job description to feel good about what you're doing. It's possible, but it takes an extra workload.
It does. And I think, you know, as much as it might take not asking for permission from other people, but negotiating, it often takes a lot of permission asking of ourselves, you know, giving yourself permission to decide, yeah, I'm not going to work like a resident anymore. I'm not going to do this or that. Letting go of that emotional turmoil that people experience of thinking, oh gosh, what if people don't like me? Oh gosh, what if I don't answer all the questions? Oh gosh, what if somebody calls me a bitch? What if I don't, you know, meet this top metric? Because we've been so socialized to create those outcomes that part of the work of, you know, working on boundaries is being willing to disappoint people, being willing to not meet other people's expectations in order that you can serve yourself, right? That you can take care of yourself. that's radical thinking to a lot of people.
Well, and the first step in all of this is the first step in any of my coaching relationships, which is, I know you're here because things aren't working out the way you planned. And in that kind of a stressful situation where you're exhausted and tapped out, the natural thing for a human to do is to focus on what they don't want and avoiding more of what you don't want. I'm going to do a little motion here. You can avoid everything you don't want, and you still won't get what you want, because the only way to get what you want is to figure out what that is and go get it. So the way that you're able to disappoint other people is when you have your personal ideal practice description figured out like a target in an archery range. And you know the reason that you're saying no to this person's request is because it's not in your ideal job description, because you've thought about it ahead of time and you're on purpose headed in that direction. And that way you can say things like, well, Dr. Mello, thank you so much for asking me to be on the tumor board. I'm honored, but I know that you need somebody who's going to participate at 100%. And I'm not going to be able to do that because that's not on my priority list for this quarter. So I'm going to say no. If there's anything I can do to help you find a person for the tumor board, let me know. But I'm not going to be able to fulfill that capacity for you. And again, thank you so much for asking. I really appreciate it. And you can be clean about it, because in your life, there are more important things than the tumor board. By the way, I only lasted on the tumor board for about 6 months, because every time they discuss another case, I would point out how it could have been either early detected or prevented.
There's that family medicine.
Those oncologists and surgeons didn't want me in the room. Didn't take long. Yeah.
Well, I love sharing with my clients language that is kind and clear, right? So we practice statements like, thank you for asking that question. We don't have time to do a good job with that today. So we're going to leave that for our next visit. We're acknowledging we heard the concern and we don't have time for a good job. We want to do a good job. Brené Brown teaches boundaries, integrity, and generosity. You know, what boundaries need to be in place for me to stand within my integrity, making the most generous assumptions of other people. It's really a powerful framework of, I don't want to do a crappy job with your concern, and I don't want to, you know, run over and just start resenting you because you're taking up too much of my time. We're going to set a boundary here, but giving people those scripts and that permission to say, this is how we're going to start saying no.
Well, and there's another way to approach it that I've always liked, which I remember the first time somebody said this phrase to me, and it still stings every time I hear it or say it. So I'm going to say it, and it might sting a little bit. You don't get what you want in life. You get what you tolerate.
Yeah.
And so what's ending up happening is that if you want to increase the quality of your life at work or at home, raise your standards. I love myself too much for me to let you do this to me any longer. I love myself too much to allow this to continue in this way. Raise your standards and stop tolerating some things that are less than optimal. Again, it really helps if you have an ideal practice description to refer to.
Yeah. And that's radical work in the medical community, where the pressure and the cultural expectation is, no, you put the patient first. No, you put your system first. Having the strength to say, my needs matter. I'm going to practice putting myself first. You know, we have to really stand in that.
One of the questions that I ask C-suite leaders, usually CEOs or CMOs, very first question I ask them when they call me to talk about burnout, maybe a burnout training or something like that, is I say, hang on a second. I got a question for you before we go any further, because I got to know whether I can help you at all. What role do you believe, R-O-L-E role, what role do you believe the health and well-being of your people plays in the quantity and the quality of the care that they provide? Mm. I'll say that again. What role do you believe the health and well-being of our people plays in the quantity? I always go quantity first, and quality of the care that they provide. And then I pledge, and I've been pretty good at this, I pledge to not be the next person who speaks. Now, there may be 30 seconds, 60 seconds, 90 seconds of complete silence, which is difficult to tolerate when there's a CEO sitting in a Zoom frame, okay? But you have to listen to what they say. It's a great psychopath test. It's a great psychopath test. If somebody thinks that's a trick question, hang up and quit that job, because it ain't no trick question. If they don't come back and say, well, of course, because what I'll say is that your ability to be present with a patient when you close the door behind you, your ability to be empathetic with that person, your ability to do a good job diagnosing and treating them, everything about the healing encounter of being a physician is dependent upon your state of well-being when you walk through that door, your energy balance and your state of well-being. Nothing is more important to you, to the patient, to the institution and its profitability than the health and well-being of the people. There's nothing that comes close.
Right.
And anybody who believes otherwise should be in manufacturing and not healthcare.
I agree. That's really acknowledging that human piece, fighting back against the widgetized. We are not doc in the box, or we don't want to be doc in the box kind of healthcare where it's just, okay, you know, you put in your order like you order in a Big Mac, right? That's not what we're doing.
Right. Although that's what the business of medicine and the maximizing the revenue model would have, interchangeable parts, just like manufacturing. So the two prime directives of healthcare education are the patient comes first. That's ultimately unhealthy. Mm-hmm. And so there has to be an off switch on that, which is one of the things that we teach called the boundary ritual. The second one is never show weakness. Never do anything to make anybody think you haven't got what it takes. And recovering from these two things that can masquerade as perfectionism, imposter syndrome, and all the shame, blame, guilt.
Yeah.
I can't take time off. What about my patients? All of those things are recovering from those two prime directives being installed at the level of the reticular activating system in the 7 years minimum that you spent in the medical education system. And thank God that they don't hold you underwater for as long these days as they did back when I was in training. I'm 65, full disclosure. So the other challenge, though, is that residents these days, as they graduate, are very differently programmed than back in my day. And is it a good thing? Probably. But it's also one of those things that causes a lot of conflict in the workplace. So, wow, there's a big rambling discussion for you. How are we going to put a bow on this?
I think we have to spend time acknowledging these very real challenges. We've got generational differences. We've got gender differences. We've got the sort of inculcation of these ideas of always put other people first that we need to let go of, right? We need to use the oxygen mask, you know, analogy of we got to put our own oxygen mask on first, right, before we help other people. But, you know, acknowledging that that's counterculture. And it needs to become the culture. We're not going to walk around and be a bunch of egotistical jerks by taking good care of ourselves. No, we are going to maximize our ability to take care of other people, to stay in this career long term, to have personal and professional satisfaction, which is what I would argue most of us are looking for. But if the system stays this way, then those of us who are trying to work against it from the inside and take care of people, we're gonna stay busy. And healthcare will keep burning through people in a way that the pandemic has really only just, shotgunned.
I think we're going to be able to rebuild sooner than later because the healthcare system as it exists now in the United States can't last until 2030. We would have to be letting in 100,000 foreign medical graduates a year because of the boomer doctor retirement cliff and the fact that the current crop of graduating residents don't work as hard as the boomers did. And the fact that 40% of female residency graduates go part-time or quit within the first 7 years of their practice. And a new study that I just saw said that, you know, a whole bunch of medical students, the majority of medical students weren't planning to see patients when they graduated. They were treating an MD like a master's degree or something.
Yeah.
So it's inevitable that between now and 2030, the American healthcare system collapses. It's happening all over right now. You're seeing, I mean, how many times are you seeing if you cruise around on LinkedIn, this hospital system's collapsing. This, what was it? It was the largest ER provider in the country went bankrupt. Envision went bankrupt. I mean, it's crazy out there.
Yeah.
So there will be places to innovate, but I'll tell you right now, honestly, it's time to circle your wagons, all of you, each of you that's listening right now, dear listener, circle your wagons right now and take care of yourself, your family, your team, your patients inside your organization and make it a little island of wellness where you can be truthful, open, honest, and transparent, real with each other and protect each other, take care of each other in these difficult times.
Yeah, it's so important. It's so critical that we learn how to do that, even though no one's going to give us permission. Leaders aren't going to tap us on the shoulder and say, you know, you ought to take more vacation days. You know, you really
max out your vacation days. I can't count the number of people who've come to me where what happens is they've got a psychopath boss and they actually are in danger and they need to get out of there. And it turns out they got 100 unused vacation days.
Right.
Don't do that.
Sometimes they just can't even get it. They request it. They can't even get it approved. You know, it's nominal only. Time to walk.
So yeah, all of these things are true. And I'm reminded of that classic technique that comes from improv. Yes, and these are polarities that cannot exist as a singularity. And they are polarities that are built into the healthcare system. If you expect it to be an industry you can apply capitalism to. And the people who are at most risk are if you are an employee. And right now is time for active measures to defend your practice and defend your humanity inside a system that isn't interested in either one. They're just interested in translating it into money as quickly as possible.
And one of my big lines is the healthcare industry is broken. The system is so full of so many problems, and let's not sit around for it to be fixed in order to feel better. So we need to take individual action.
Right.
We need, you know, to do the work that you and I do, right, in really helping to heal some of these wounds. I'd love for, you know, the right people to be in the right rooms making the decisions that turn this big cruise ship around and fixes the American healthcare system, but I'm no longer going to wait for it. I've got to take care of me and mine.
Yep. And there is no fix because it's not a problem.
Sure. It's a dilemma.
That needs a strategy. And again, we're a federation of states. You see the healthcare system so different from state to state to state. Like as we film this in Alabama, an embryo is a child.
Right.
Which is insane.
Yeah. I have a lot of thoughts on that.
Let's not go there. That's another time.
Like, we're not going to go there. Let's just say that Washington is a welcoming state for people running into lots of challenges. Oh, man. Yeah, it's a whole different ballgame.
Right on. Well, this has been Dyke Drummond and Megan Mello. Yellow. Mello, she said it, not me.
I did. They call me Mello Yellow.
Dr. Megan Mello at healthierforgood.com, talking about boundaries, physician wellness, the healthcare industry. Residents like cookies, and so do regular doctors, all that kind of stuff. Any last words?
Oh, I just want to reiterate, we need to take care of ourselves, and that's going to feel selfish and wrong and uncomfortable. And that doesn't mean it's a sign it's wrong. Let's accept that we're going to trade the frustration, resentment, overwhelm for feelings of discomfort when we start taking care of ourselves, setting boundaries, saying no to people, disappointing others. It's uncomfortable. That's normal. We'll get better, but may not be perfect.
And I'll take that even one little step further. If you're feeling a sense of shame or guilt, or what if they find out, it's probably because you're contemplating setting a healthy boundary. Mm-hmm. They actually come together.
Yeah.
Because again, as a resident, that's where this was installed. So yeah, those feelings are actually a sign that you're probably thinking about doing something that's pretty darn healthy. So rock on, live long and prosper, all that good stuff. Illegitimi non carborundum. That's it for today. Latest edition of the Physicians on Purpose podcast. Till we talk again, keep breathing. Have a great rest of your day.
Bye now.